It's one of these things people say that when something really bad happens, something good comes out of it. And I found my passion for running. I love running. It's my passion. I live to run.
This One's Radio, episode 534, starts in 3, 2. Welcome back to Diz Runs Radio, where I talk with runners from all corners of the running world about running, life, and everything in between. I'm your host, Denny Cray, and it's just about time to head out the door for an easy run and a great conversation. So if you're ready, then I'm ready. Let's get started. Hey guys, real quick, just before we dive into today's episode of the show, just want to thank the good folks over at healthiq.com for sponsoring today's episode. As runners, you know, we try to be health conscious, right? Like we try to be healthier. And that's part of, you know, for a lot of folks, at least part of the reason that we run is to try to be health conscious as well. So, as such, HealthIQ has partnered with life insurance companies from around the country to help give us better rates, lower rates because of our decreased odds of having some serious health issues in relation to the general public. So if you are in the market for some new health insurance coverage, or you need some additional coverage based on, you know, life circumstance changes, things like that, where you need to reassess the amount of life insurance that you have in case, you know, in case the unfortunate should happen, the best thing that you can do as a runner is head over to healthiq.com/dizruns and see what kind of rates you could get by filling out a little bit of information there. And if you happen to just talk to one of the agents, make sure you let them know as well that you heard about it here on Diz Runs Radio. So thanks to HealthIQ for sponsoring today's episode. Once again, healthiq.com/dizruns. And now let's go ahead and get on with today's episode of the show. Hey guys, one of the things I love most about doing this show is that it gives me the opportunity to connect with runners, but ultimately people who are more, much more than just runners. And today's guest is absolutely no exception. We connected on Twitter just a few weeks back, and we had some back and forth conversations, and it became pretty clear to me that she would make a pretty fun guest for the show, and so here we are. In addition to being a runner, today's guest is also a passionate foodie and also a writer of history. Her novel, James's Journey, is a historical fiction work about the son of a slave owner that actually becomes a conductor of the Underground Railroad while slavery was still going on here in the United States. So I'm looking forward to what is probably going to be a pretty wide-ranging chat. Who knows all the places we'll go, but I've got a feeling it's going to be a lot of fun and with my guest today, Ms. Helen Lundstrom Irwin. So thanks for joining us today, Helen. Really appreciate it, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is certainly mine. And guys, if you want to connect with Helen, find out more about what she's got going on, obviously check out the book, things of that nature. HelenIrwin.com is kind of her author website, HelenIrwin, HelenIrwin.com. And ExercisingFoodies.com is more of the blog, running stuff, food stuff, obviously, kind of everything else mixed in between there, ExercisingFoodies.com. And on the Twitter, the handle is @ExercisingFoodie, but that is no E at the beginning of it. So it's just the letter X as in Exercising Foodie on the Twitter. And as per usual, we'll have everything linked up, links to the book, links to the websites, Twitter, the whole nine yards, in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at dizruns.com/534. So, Helen, the way we always start off each episode, each conversation is with the same question, a simple question, but sometimes the answer is simple, and sometimes, boy, the answer can be a little bit difficult for certain folks. But it's just a fun place to get started, and a kind of a good launching off point, easy for me to say. But that's just to ask, what is your favorite distance to race and why?
That's a great question. I don't race much, but the one I did most recent was a 10K, and I like that. That was nice. I think that's a good distance for me if I race. But I love to run alone, either with my two dogs by my side or by myself. And I run mostly up and down the Hudson River path here in New York City, where I live. But I also spend a lot of time in Sweden. Mm-hmm. So I often run there on little country roads in the, you know, out in the woods. And I love that. And I also run at my sister-in-law's house in New Jersey, in Titusville. It's a beautiful area. It's very, very hilly. And it's hard. It is constant hills, and I like it, but it's tough. It's a challenge. It's very good for me to do that. But Sweden or the Hudson River Path, I really enjoy and do mostly. Or at the treadmill at the gym. Mm. And then I listen to podcasts.
Like there you go.
Yours.
Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, with as per usual, you know, one of the reasons I like this question is because it always gives me so many other follow-up questions that I can ask to come off of. But you said you typically tend to run by yourself or with the dogs, but without other people. I don't know if why is quite the right way of asking what I want to ask. But what do you enjoy maybe about the time? Is it just a chance to be by yourself? Or why do you enjoy the solo running as much as you do?
That's a great question. Let me think. I'm more of a loner, I think. Mm-hmm. So to have space on my own and just be outside is wonderful. And I love to listen to music when I run. And if it's beautiful outside and I listen to something really beautiful, I feel very empowering and very freeing. I started running when my mother died. I was going through a very hard time when she passed away because she lived in Sweden and I lived here in New York, and she died suddenly. And she died 11 days after my dog died.
Oh, no.
And yeah, it was hard. And she was ill. She had COPD, and she, excuse me, her doctor spoke to me and said, you know, she's not doing too well, but we're expecting her to go home soon because I called. Do I need to fly home now? Mm-hmm. And they said, no, don't worry. You know, she's doing well. You know, she's ill. She's definitely ill, but this is not something that you have to rush home for. We want her to come home. Our goal is to get her to go home without oxygen. So I said, okay. So I was in between jobs then. I wasn't a full-time writer yet, and I was in between jobs. And I had a new job coming up. I was leaving my other job, and I thought, okay, maybe I can wait. But then it became clear, let me just go home and help her when she gets home from the hospital. So I booked a ticket, and I didn't make it. Mm. And she died suddenly, and I didn't make it home. And it was devastating, and I was a mess. And I had run a little bit before this, but not much. And I was mostly biking and going to the gym and lifting some weights and things like that. But biking was my main thing. But living in New York City, biking isn't as fun because there's a lot of people. And so it's running is better here. So I started running, and it saved me. I don't know how I would have survived this time with losing my mom suddenly and everything. I was dealing with a lot of guilt, not being near her when she passed. And it was really hard. And running saved my life. And it's one of these things people say, that when something really bad happens, something good comes out of it. And I found my passion for running. I love running. It's my passion. I live to run. It's my favorite thing to do, even if I do it alone and not racing much.
And there's nothing, you know, you're preaching to the choir about people that love to run. I mean, that's, you know, that's everybody that's listening right now. And I think that for a lot of us, whether we tend to enjoy running with others or not, there's definitely something about running alone that just, you know, whatever it's just good for what ails you. It's good for the mind. It's good for the soul. It's good for you know, grieving or times of struggle. It's a great thing to do and just kind of to revel in times of, you know, of good times or wins or things like that. It's just one of those universal things. But in that time period for you when you were getting into it, you know, if I heard you correctly, you weren't much of a runner before that. Was it something where when you got the news of your mom passing and that grief of, oh my gosh, I didn't get home in time and all of that roller coaster of emotions that I'm sure you were feeling, did you turn to running right away, or what was the kind of push that put you in that direction that allowed you to find this passion for running that you now clearly have?
I think it was because I was very anxious and angry and going through all these stages of grief, and I had a lot of anxiety, and I meditate also, and people always say, oh, it's so great, Helen, you can sit down and meditate. But when you're under stress and your heart is racing, it's really hard to meditate. And I felt a real need. I need to burn this adrenaline off. And, you know, I was pretty fit since I biked, but it's still not the same as running. So it was hard in the beginning, but I really enjoyed it. And I kept going. I walked a little, I ran a little, walked a little, ran a little. And then one day I just kept running, and it really helped. I don't know if it's, you might be able to tell me this, if it's true, but it feels like it burns off excess adrenaline in your body. Does it do that? Because I feel much calmer after I run.
You know, I'm not going to try to speak on the physiological aspect of that question, but I totally agree with you that there is something about if you're stressed out and you just go, boy, it does help you calm down. So I will I'll agree 100% with what you just said.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so it really, really helped me, and it saved me, and it made me cope. I felt less angry and less anxious. And then when my father died now in a year and a half ago, it was much more expected, and I was more prepared and wasn't at all the same. I didn't deal with the same things, but I think having run for 5 years prior, I had a tool to deal with all the stress that came. So it was really, really helpful. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like you said, you had that tool. So instead of things building up until they got to the breaking point, potentially, you know, every one of those runs could have been kind of a stress reliever in the lead up to your dad's ultimate passing. And you know, there's still going to be grief, obviously, but, you know, it hadn't built up like it probably, or like at least like it sounds like it may have done with your mother.
Yeah, very true. It's a very good way of putting it. It built up, and it's, you know, it comes out in a racing heartbeat and all kinds of other emotions. So yeah, running was very, very helpful. Whenever something's stressful, running helps. It's wonderful. It helps when I write too. If I'm stuck on something, I go for a run, and then sometimes things come to me. And so it's great. And I love ultras. That's how we connected.
Yes.
And they really changed my life, those shoes.
Yes.
They're amazing shoes. And
it's just like anything. You find the thing that works for you, and boy, if you find the right little piece of gear, or the right this, the right that, it definitely makes a big difference. And glad that for you, you know, it happened to be those shoes. And I know that's, like you said, that's how we connected. You had a question, and you know, the rest is history. I answered and back and forth, and here we are.
You mentioned
earlier, you know, some of the different places you run tend to run a lot in the Hudson area in New York City there, but also in Sweden. And in case folks haven't put that together yet, I think they probably have, but you know, you're a native Swede, living here in the States, married and living here and working in New York and whatnot. But from the times that you go back and forth to Sweden, I think I remember from the website that you still tend to be over there in the summertime for at least a little while to kind of reconnect with family and friends over there. I'm assuming that when you're over there, you do some running. What's the running community or the running vibe, or what's running like in Sweden for those of us that have never been there and have no other frame of reference for running in different parts of the world than whatever we have in our local area here in the United States?
That's a good question. I think Sweden is similar to here. There's a lot of racing, and running is trendy now there. So a lot of people run, and it's similar in that way, I think, to here. But one big difference that I think you might really like, and especially people who like trail running, Sweden has something called the All Man's Right. And that's very unusual. And it means that the whole country is a national park. So you can run everywhere. There is no private land where you're not allowed to go. You can even camp on people's property, and as long as you're not too close to other people and their houses, and you don't, you know, break something, you don't cut down somebody's tree, and you're not within hearing distance of somebody's house, and you're sitting out there, you know, disturbing people. But if you run down the road and you see a little trail into the woods next to a house, and, you know, don't go into their garden, but you can very well just run into the woods. And it's amazing. It's really, people, a lot of Germans travel to Sweden for this alone, because it's free. You can be everywhere. And I don't do a lot of trail running, but I like to run on, like I said earlier, little tiny, there's a lot of gravel roads. We have a little cottage in Sweden, and it's out in the woods, and there's most of the roads are paved, but some of them are just dirt roads, and it's wonderful to run there. And that's also when I often bring my dogs. We travel with the dogs to Sweden also, so they come and they run there, and it's really, really nice. And not as populated, so it's emptier, which is also nice if you're a loner and like to run like I do.
If you like to, I mean, that would be definitely something I would enjoy a good bit of, is just the ability to just to go explore. Like you said, you see a little trail or a little something that, you know, like, you don't have to worry about somebody coming out and being upset and yelling at you and chasing you off the property or whatever. Like, oh, that would be a lot of fun. I mean, talk about keeping things from getting boring. You wouldn't have to run the same route all the time, because it's just almost endless opportunities to just go off-road and go explore.
Exactly. It's wonderful. And I really, really like that. I walk in the woods with the dogs too, which is really nice. I want to tell you about the time when I ran. It's actually not near the cottage, but it's near the place where my husband and I got married several years ago. In 94, so it's 24 years ago. It's an area where there's cows and sheep and horses on pasture together in a huge expanse. And there's a road that goes right through it, and it just has a cattle grid for the cars to drive across. And then you're out in the midst of this, and it's near the sea. And it goes on for miles and miles and miles. And I ran there last year. Let me see. Yeah, last year. And it was a little scary, but amazing. But the animals are right near you. And the horses and the cows, they're huge. for a while I was running, and there was a horse galloping right next to me, and we kind of looked at each other, and there are cows, and I assume they're all cows and not bulls, or should they be bulls also? I don't know how that works.
I mean, I feel like from what little farm knowledge I have, the bulls are a lot more grumpy, so you probably would have known if they were bulls, because they probably wouldn't have been too happy that you were there.
Okay. Yeah. So they were good to know. So yeah, it was very safe, but I had my respect for them. And there was one little cluster of trees that I ran through, and there was one really large cow that kind of walked toward me. I was like, okay, I think I should probably get off the road here. So I kind of just walked or ran off and walked into the grass a little, and he just looked at me. He's like, yeah, a person. And then I continued on, but it was beautiful. And if you ever travel to Sweden, I will promise I'll take you there myself, because you would love this place. It's beautiful.
I may hold you to that, because that's one of those that basically all of Scandinavia are, you know, kind of just a place that I would love to travel to and visit. And from, of course, everything that you hear about it, which is, you know, nothing but good things most of the time. It is exactly like you're describing, lots of nature, lots of open area, and just a beautiful part of the world to go explore.
It really is. Have you been?
I have not. No, I'm one of those terrible Americans that has a passport with no stamps in it. You know, I got it, and I have it in case I ever need it, I guess. But yeah, I've never used it, and something that I want to remedy sooner rather than later. But, you know, of course, you got to balance the finances and the family and the whole nine yards to do all that traveling. But yeah, I would love to go explore lots of places around the world and just see some different ways of living and beautiful parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is nice when you can do that, for sure. And if you do want to go to Sweden, please don't hesitate. Let me know. And if we happen to be there at that time, well, you're welcome to visit, and I can show you my running spots.
Oh, well, I like I said, I will be sure to let you know. And if nothing else, you can at least give me the insider's guide on some places to go and check out if you're not going to be there at the same time, if we're not going to overlap.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
So I do want to talk a good bit about the book, because I'm very much interested in it, and also maybe a little bit, and we already touched on it just a little bit, but kind of how sometimes the running can kind of help when you get into a little bit of a writer's block, and we'll keep blurring or merging the running and mm-hmm. the book itself. But first, do want to take a second and pay a bill real quick. Thank the folks from Health IQ for sponsoring today's episode. Again, guys, they're going to be on for a few weeks. We got a nice little chunk of shows that they wanted to sponsor and talk about what the company does. And basically the simple term is that if you're looking for life insurance, they work with life insurance providers to provide the lowest rates possible for runners and active people who are living healthy lifestyles, making good choices that are going to, statistically mean that we're going to live longer. So if you're in the position where you need to reassess, or are you kind of, first part of the year, still in the early part of 2018, you need to reassess the amount of life insurance coverage that you have. As runners, you're not going to get a better rate unless you go through Health IQ. So healthiq.com/dizruns is the link to let them know that you came from the show. And you can also mention that you heard about Health IQ here on Diz Runs Radio. And that way they'll know that their advertising dollars are working, keeps them happy, keeps us happy, and keeps you happy, because you're getting the best price that you can possibly get on your life insurance. So thanks to Health IQ for sponsoring today's episode. So Helen, the book, and I have so many questions about the book, and who knows how many of them we'll get to. We'll see as we go along here. But first and foremost, let's kind of just tell everybody kind of about the book itself. So James's Journey is the title of the book. It's a historical fiction piece written in the era of the slave days, the Underground Railroad, abolition, the whole, kind of late 18 or middle 1800s, I guess, if I had to put the time frame on it. What is the other than that, a little bit more detail, what is the book all about? And we'll start from there and continue to kind of dig into it as we go.
Thank you. You already explained it really well. But I think more than that, it's about the Underground Railroad and abolitionists. It's about a man that was for slavery that then changed his mind and realized what slavery really was. So you might be familiar with the term, the plantation myth, and that's what we call it that now. And that's what people used to tell each other to justify slavery. And they used to say that, that enslaved people, they were happy to live on the plantation and they were well taken care of. And not only that, they also were said to be better off on the plantation and enslaved than free. And so when I did my research for my novel, I studied this and learned about it, and I was honestly surprised. I don't really know what I had expected, but I hadn't expected that people would say that it was good for the enslaved to be enslaved. So James, my character, he grew up thinking this, and he's an only child, and he lives on a plantation in Virginia, a tobacco plantation, and he wants to go to New York, and so he goes to New York, and there he gets in touch with abolitionists, and he first thinks that they're crazy. He's like, like he doesn't understand why they don't understand how happy all the enslaved people are, and he thinks that they don't really know what they're talking about. And he thinks back on his own childhood and how his one of the women who were enslaved on his plantation that raised him used to give him raspberries when he came back home and he was tired, and how wonderful she was and how much she loved him and how happy she was. And then a couple of things happen on the plantation, and he starts to rethink his views. And then he gets invited to Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, where Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother had a congregation that was abolitionist, and he was very outspoken against slavery. And so he went there, and sitting in church as he's speaking, he's taken aback, and this is not really how it is, but it's really nudging at him. And then he has a conversation afterwards with his friends that took him there, and they start talking about how nice it is at home on the plantation and how happy everyone is there. And then he says, oh yeah, well, my parents, you know, they never sold anybody away. And then suddenly, wait, we bought people. Oh, and he suddenly remembers that one of the women that his father had bought, she was separated from her child. And he remembers her screaming when they are separated. And he remembers how she was found dead later in the snow. And that's, I think, is one of the moments where he's starting to really struggle with this. And so he's struggling with this. He changes his mind, and he, after a while, he's fully on the side of the abolitionists. But then he's still thinking, this is my parents' livelihood, and what, this is how I grew up, and this isn't. But he's struggling, and he's thinking, and then he's fully on the side of the abolitionists, and he meets a woman who's an abolitionist. And I don't want to spoil too much of the plot, but he has to go back to the plantation. Mm-hmm. And now he's an abolitionist and very much against slavery, but he has to take care of his own plantation with enslaved people on it.
Right.
And so he wants to free everybody, and then he learns that there's laws in Virginia, and his neighbors are not happy with his change of views, and it's becoming very complicated.
Right, right. Yeah, it's terrible. Well, and you know, from not obviously not being in that time, but just from you look at slavery from from the wide-angled lens, or just that time in our country from wide-angled lens, and you know, like, well, how could we ever do that? But then, like you said, there's And as the as it sounds like the story goes, looking forward to reading through it and really kind of seeing all the tangled webs that are created. It's there's a lot of layers to it, and there's a lot of different viewpoints and just a whole lot of things. And not trying to excuse anything, obviously, but just, I mean, it's just a very complicated subject. And with all that kind of, you know, with the overview of the story and just the topic in general, you know, as somebody who is from another country. What drew you to this type of topic to be something that you would write a historical novel about? Because there's a million different topics you could have picked, and this is one of the most touchy, you know, dirty, not proud moments maybe of the United States, you know, the evolution of our country. What drew you to this topic to write your novel about?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I used to think exactly the same thing. I didn't grow up knowing about this too much, and I would never have thought I would write about this. But then something happened that made this very personal. And I just want to touch a little again, like before I tell you about this, it's my people that have read my book have liked that you see both sides of this, even though it's a horrible side. I think it's important that you see what people thought and the ones that were for slavery, why they thought that they could do this. But so to go back to what your question, my husband, he doesn't, it's a roundabout way of explaining what happened. He doesn't like to pay for things that he feels he doesn't need to pay for. And so so one day we got a letter from our building that said that our locker was going to charge us the double. And he said, no, we're not paying the double for this locker with all my mother's stuff. We're not doing that. So he emailed them and said, nope. And said, well, that's kind of what we're doing. But if you want to change lockers, we have a smaller locker that you could use. So he said, okay, we'll do that. So he spent an afternoon cleaning out the locker in the basement. And he found an old book that his mother had kept that was written by a distant cousin of my husband. And it was about a relative of my husband. And it was about his life on his farm and how he went to church and his community. And in the end of this book was his estate manifest from when he died. And all the things that he owned were listed in this manifest. And there were broken farm equipment, there were broken pottery, there were tools, chairs, and six people. And I was floored. I had never expected this. My husband had no idea. And there were six people, and it listed their names, where, who bought them, and where they went, and they were all separated. There were a woman in her 30s with an infant, and she was sold together with this infant. And there were small children, a six-year-old boy, he was sold separately, and a man in his 30s was also sold separately. And I don't know, they may not have been a family, but my instinct says that they were a family. And the man who enslaved them, he died, and they were just sold off. And they were listed right underneath broken pottery, which for some reason really got to me. And I kept seeing the woman with the six-year-old. I kept, just had her in my mind, and I saw her with this little infant in her arms, and just, I was very affected by this. And I thought, okay, I don't know. I want to find out how they could do this. Why did they think it was okay? And that's where my story came from, because I really wanted to know why. I know they did it. I know it's a horrible history, but how? Mm-hmm. How can you sell six people? And what were they thinking? And that's how I got to, that's why James was for slavery first, because I wanted to see why. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he changed, and he tried to do everything he could to change everything in his community and help people. And so that's where that came from, and it was a very powerful experience, and it, writing it was really amazing. It came, he just came to me, and then his story was, came out, and I wrote James's journey. And
Gotcha. How much in I don't know if you can even quantify this, but I'm going to ask just because it's one of, you know, mm-hmm. one of the genres of fiction that I do enjoy is historical fiction, because it's you know, and as a reader, I usually play the game of, you know, how much of this is true, or at least, you know, very probably could be true, and how much of this is complete, you know, fiction and you know, the product of the author's imagination and mind and kind of piecing it together. If you had to classify it in James's journey, what percentage of the book would you say either is true or very, very likely would have been something that someone living in that era, in that you know, part of that maybe shared those similar types of thoughts or beliefs or whatever, could have been true? And how much of it is just, you know, poetic license, for lack of a better way of asking it?
No, I am so glad you asked this. James himself is made up, and his little town and his community is made up, but there are many things in it that is true. His Henry Ward Beecher, which is Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother, he was an abolitionist, and he did have he was the pastor at Plymouth Church, and it is true that a lot of people went to his church. Most of them were abolitionists themselves, but many went just to see what the crazy abolitionists thought, and there were thousands of people in these services, and that part is true. It's also, let me see, I tie in several things. He meets Dr. McCune Smith when he's in New York, and that was the first African-American physician and pharmacist in the U.S., and he became educated in Glasgow. And Harriet Tubman has a very small role in it, but she's mentioned. She's kind of my inspiration for writing also. And a very interesting person is Moncure Conway. And he is very similar to James. And I came upon him by mistake. And my husband and I were driving to research my book a little, and we were exhausted, and we had made a reservation in a motel, and it was kind of far, and we just see a sign along the road that says motels, and I was like, you know what, let's cancel that and let's go. So we went, we got another motel, we stayed there, and I just Googled the area, and I come upon Moncure Conway, who is an amazing, or was an amazing man. Very similar story. He grew up with slaves, was pro-slavery first, and then he changed his mind, and he became an abolitionist, and he tried to help his father's slaves flee. So it is very, very similar. So he's a real person who's in my book. And there's other things that are part of the story that I reference to that are also part of history. And so I try my very best to stay as close to the truth as I can. And then, you know, I have, you know, license as a writer also to make the story more interesting. But there's many things in there, and I have a foreword in there that explains some of the history also. And I think you can learn a lot from reading it, or not just you, but people who aren't that familiar with the Underground Railroad. And the history itself can learn things in Google and things like that. And that's how I'm inspired to write. If I find something in history that I find very interesting, then I Google it and I write about it, and I can't just create something from nothing. But if there's an interesting historical period, that's how I get my inspiration.
Well, and for anybody who enjoys history, there's no shortage of interesting historical periods, no matter where around the world. I mean, every corner of the world has interesting history that for some of us, if you don't really study history, it kind of almost sounds kind of fable-ish, and then you start to look into it and learn the stories and things of that nature. When you're doing mm-hmm. that, when you find something that strikes you and you decide to research it and then write about it, at what point... do you feel like, or maybe ever, I don't know, do you feel like you've done enough research? Because I feel like with history, there's always another thing to, another trail to chase. There's always another thing to learn more about. And boy, you could get lost in doing nothing but research forever and never end up writing anything. Where do you tend to draw the line? Or is it case by case?
I think it's case by case, but I think I might be a little unusual because I write and research at the same time, because I figure out what to research as I write. And it can be something as simple as having coffee and I'm sitting there writing something. Right now I'm writing a book that's set in the 17th century and sitting there, oh, it would be nice with a cup of coffee. And like, wait, coffee? Okay, let me look into this. Oh, no, they didn't have coffee at this time yet. Okay, I have to rethink this. And then it goes like that. And I write something and then it's like, wait, let me check. Oh, it's like this. That's very interesting. I have to have this in there. And so there's a lot like that. It's a lot like that. But for sure, there's so much to research. And I can't always get to everything. I do my best, but... Right. There's always more, and
it is, and you know that's something that, like I said, I sometimes have to stay away from various topics, you know, whether it's on History Channel or just doing, just looking on the internet or whatever, because I know that if I start to get into it too much, like, where does the wormhole stop? You just keep going and going and going. Mm-hmm. And there's more and more and more, and it's fascinating. Where did your love of history come from to kind of make this something that is your livelood now, you know, outside of the passions of running and the food? I mean, this is a big thing of researching, writing, all of these things, you know, history related. Where did that come from?
Oh, what a great question. I don't know. I think what I like more about history maybe than just history itself is like what I said before. Like why people did this, why they thought this. And also I really enjoy when there's things that we take for granted today that wasn't obvious earlier. Things we just open a faucet, for example, I can tell you one scene that there's one scene in my book where this goes back a little to your research question, where one of my characters, she puts a key on the inside of her bra. And then my editor said, no, you got to check this. And it didn't exist yet. So then, sorry, I'm probably backtracking, but then she had to wear something else. Mm-hmm. And we take all these things for granted today, just to turn the light on, there's electricity, I can't really think of a good example other than things like electricity and water and clothing, but we take so much for granted, and people lived really harsh lives before, and they didn't have enough food to eat, and it was cold. The 17th century, the 1600s in Sweden, was called the Little Ice Age. It was extremely cold, and you know, just the implications of how it would be to live at that time, where it's so cold. People starved to death, and so I think my interest comes from learning how people survived in these different times and why they needed to do what they did and what they thought about things and why they thought about things and why they had the opinions that they had. And I think it's very interesting with James and how he changed, and how in the future people will look at us and they would say, well, why did you do this week? Didn't you understand? How could you think that? And now we're looking back and we're as confused and surprised that people had those opinions then. But
I was just saying that's a great perspective, because I'll use the blanket term nobody and recognize that there's always an exception to every rule, but nobody does anything that they know is just ridiculous. I know this is a terrible choice. I know this is a terrible way to behave. Like just about everybody has a rationale. They can reason why they did it. And then, with the history and the hindsight being 2020, you look back and go, how could anybody have thought that? But humans forever have been guilty of that, and justify the Crusades or justify this or justify that, and you look back and go, like, what, like, how? And I love that's what drives you, is that kind of looking into what they could have been thinking that would have led them to act and do the things that they did.
Exactly. Thank you. That's exactly it. That's really what drives me, and that's what I think is so interesting. And because it's really like that, like you said, we're all wondering now, and we don't understand. But it's thank you.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And as we're getting to the point of wrapping up, Helen, I want to kind of tie the running back into the writing bit, and see if we can't end on a philosophical question that does both. So I'm gonna maybe not always happens, but fairly regularly when I ask the philosophical question at the end of the episode, I have a list of four or five questions, and every once in a while I'll go off script of my list because of how the conversation went and something that just pops into my head and sounds interesting. And I would be curious, and maybe there's an answer to this and maybe not, and whatever, however this goes is how we'll kind of wrap things up today. But is there a person or a story or a moment in running history that you are interested enough, or maybe haven't gotten to that point yet, but might consider starting to do the research and telling a story and diving into the why as it relates to a person, a figure, a moment, like I said, anything related to running in history where you could maybe blend those two parts of your world and really put them together to tell a story?
Wow, I am so excited. I have not thought of this. I would love to do that. That would be amazing. Because there are a lot of runners, and there's a lot of ancient history, how the marathon started and things like that. That would be amazing. I have not even thought of that. Thank you very much. Well, that's a great, great question. I haven't yet, but now you have that. I'm going to think about that.
we'll leave that question open, and when that book is around, just like I have the invite to you when it comes to traveling to Sweden, you have the invite to me or from me to come back, and we'll talk about that book whenever that comes to fruition. I can't wait to hear about it.
Thank you. I would love to do that.
Certainly. And guys, as we're wrapping up, again, HelenIrwin.com is the website with all of the author information, and ExercisingFoodies.com is the website that's more runner-focused and foodie-focused. We didn't even get into the foodie stuff today, but you can do some looking around there as well. And on the Twitter, at ExercisingFoodie. Again, that's exercising without an E at the beginning, so it's X-E-R, sizing foodie on the Twitter. DizRuns.com/534 is the link to everything. And once again, James's Journey is the title of the book, historical fiction, very well written, definitely worth checking out. So, you know, if you're looking for something, maybe not a fun and lighthearted read, but a good historical novel, entertaining, it's worth it. Check it out. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the places where books are found, get it there. And Helen, thank you so much for taking the time today. Thanks for coming on. Hope this was okay for you. But thanks again. Just thanks for the time. Glad we connected and looking forward to stay connected. Wishing you nothing but the best going forward and looking forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this, Denny. Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to today's episode of the show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation between Helen and myself. And as always, I'd be curious to know what stood out to you from this episode. What was your takeaway moment from the conversation today? For me, it really kind of boils down to actually something about Helen's book. When Helen was describing some of the plot points and kind of the journey that James goes on in her book, you know, she mentioned the idea that he really had a pretty much a complete 180, a dramatic change of mind in how he thought about slavery before and how he thought about slavery when he got to the end of the book. And my takeaway has nothing to do with slavery, thankfully. I haven't changed my mind there. I still don't think it was a good thing, quite clearly. But the idea of being able to change your mind dramatically about a subject is something that I think sometimes we almost look at that as a bad thing. And especially when you get into politics, and I'm not going to get into politics, you know, here and all of that, but you know, every campaign season you hear, oh, so-and-so supported this and now they're against it. Like that's a bad thing. And I think that it's important to remember as humans and as runners that, you know, as we are exposed to different situations, as we learn about different things, as there's new research, as there's new information available, changing your mind isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, as new information presents itself, the responsible thing to do is reassess what do I know now versus what did I not used to know in the past, and how does that change how I look about a situation in the future? And you know, on the running front, I mean, I've kind of dramatically changed how I've trained in the last, certainly in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, before I read 80/20 running, I was that guy that was running too hard all the time, and then I tried to dial it back. And now in the last few months, I've really gone even more all in on the heart rate training philosophy. And now I rarely ever run a hard workout or a hard effort. You know, once or twice or maybe 3 times a month is about it. So, you know, I've changed my philosophy on how I train myself, and that may trickle down into how I train with my clients. I want to run the experiment a little bit longer and see what the results are. But, you know, I mean, it's a change in my philosophy, a dramatic change of mind. And I don't see that as a negative. And again, I think too often we see when somebody has a dramatic change of mind, like, oh, you know, they're just wishy-washy. They're going with whatever the fancy thing is, whether it's diet related, training related, life related, politics, whatever. And I don't see that as being a bad thing. And so that was my takeaway. Just a reminder that, you know, the reason we all have reasons that we do the things that we do. But if we decide to change our mind, there's probably a compelling reason there as well. And that change isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just part of life. It's part of experience. It's part of growing and becoming a better person. Hopefully we're making those changes because hopefully we become a better person. So anyway, a little bit long-winded, but that was my takeaway from this episode, that it's okay to change your mind, even on something that you feel like you're really holding dear. If the evidence dictates to change your mind, it's okay to change your mind. If you know, and this, you know, even though this is a fictional story from that Helen wrote, like she said, there's plenty of examples in history that, and probably dozens more that are undocumented, which would show that in that same situation, lots of people did change their mind, and that's probably was a good thing that those minds were changed. So anyway, that was my takeaway. What was yours? Let me know on the Twitters at DizRuns, on the email DizRuns@gmail.com. And you can always head over to the show notes. And for this episode, that would be DizRuns.com/534. And you can leave a comment there about what stood out to you from this episode, what your takeaway was. And if/when you get the book and read the book, you can head over there and leave a comment on what you thought about the book. I'd be interested to hear that information and what your takeaway from the book was, or just what your impression of the book was as well. And we'll be sure to pass those along to Helen as well if you post those up on the website so she can get more feedback on her book and looking forward to the next book that comes out from her as well. So anyway, that wraps it up for today. Thank you guys for listening. A little bit longer outro than usual, but thanks for hanging on to the end. HealthIQ.com/DizRuns. Thanks again to those that support the sponsors, because that helps keep the lights on here and keeps the show moving in the right direction. So thank you for that. And thanks to HealthIQ for sponsoring this episode. And with that, the bow is officially on. We're tightening the knot. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, please be well, take good care, and we'll talk soon. See you guys.